Well, we've got really a fine guest this evening. He's become an author, and also he's appeared in several movies and so forth. He was born December 29th, 1984 in New York City, and his name is Sean Christopher Stone. He's an actor and director. He's known for Natural Born Killers. He's got a book out that's just been released through Trine Day, and that the name of that book, it's entitled New World Order, A Strategy of Imperialism. Welcome to our program, Sean Stone.
Well, thank you so much for having me join.
I tell you what, there's an individual in your book here that you seem to focus on, okay? Elliot is his name. And tell us, his name was William Yandell Elliott. First, how did you come to write this book? Tell us that first.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, William Yandell Elliott was sort of the subject of this focus of the story. It is bigger than him, but I basically came across his name in doing some research that he was a mentor to Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski, Samuel Huntington, and many more very prominent political personalities, let's say, because Elliot was the professor emeritus of government and politics at Harvard for about 40 years, all through really like the late 20s all the way to the 60s at Harvard. So he obviously had a tremendous influence on the brain trust and the people around Kennedy, for example. Kennedy himself took his class when he was at Harvard. So a lot of prominent intellectuals and scholars were trained by this fellow. And I was very curious to know more about him. And this is when I was at Princeton doing my senior thesis work, because I was preparing my thesis for my history degree. And in the process, I ended up writing I studied Elliot and getting into this world of his background, which is very much the Anglo-American establishment. So when you read the book, you'll see a lot of references made to Carol Quigley, who was a prominent Georgetown professor, who wrote his book Tragedy and Hope in the 60s. And it was pretty shocking because he basically says, yes, there has been this conspiracy by, you know, he called it the Anglo-American establishment, the Round Table Group out of England, and their association with the prominent banks like J.P. Morgan and others, basically to perpetuate the British Empire and in more informal ways, like the British Commonwealth was one such way of adopting that name as opposed to the British Empire. So that roundtable group and the Anglo-American establishment very much intersects with what Elliot was a part of. Elliot was basically a disciple of that group. And so what I was looking at was what was the worldview of the British Empire at the turn of the century, and how they were looking to reincorporate America into that empire informally again through alliances, through political relationships, and most importantly through intellectual goals, let's say, so sort of the political philosophical goals of empire. And so this is essentially what the New World Order is. People can get into the more esoteric aspects of it, there's obviously other angles to look at, but this one is this New World Order that I'm looking at is strictly what is the aspiration of essentially dissolving nation states into larger supranational organizations, right? Trying to take away nation state sovereignty, trying to basically put them into agreements, whether it be legal agreements, trade agreements, all sorts of things like this, to basically strip away the constitutional authority of a state with its relationship with its own people.
Yeah, that seems to ring a bell with the North American Union. Is that what they're pushing now for this hemisphere?
I mean, that's an argument that's been around for a few years now. Frankly, we haven't seen it happen. There are a lot of people who, I remember 5 years ago, were saying the Amero is about to come into existence, and basically they're going to have a new currency called the Amero, and they're going to launch it from Denver, Colorado, and that'll basically supersede the dollar. Well, we haven't seen that happen. I don't know that really is going to take place. What we've seen, obviously, instead of the North American Union, we've seen, obviously, NAFTA. And that has done a lot of damage, you know, to the U.S. economy and also to the Mexican economy, frankly. It really has taken away the power of our tariffs to protect our industries and manufacturers. But it also seems to perhaps be part of an overall drug pushing strategy, let's say, I would call it. There's look, we look historically at the relationship of not just the CIA and the intelligence community, but also the people like the Bush family in particular, who have a very strong relationship to the drug traffic, especially cocaine out of Latin America in the late 1970s, escalating under when Bush Sr. was vice president in the 1980s with the Contra War. Obviously, tremendous amounts of cocaine were moved out of Latin America and oftentimes protected by the CIA and, people like Oliver North and his enterprise, right? So the point is that some of these agreements would, in a sense, seem to ultimately work towards allowing for the drug traffic to continue, and then all that drug money gets, basically supports these major international banks. Now you look at what is the biggest bank in Mexico, Citibank. And Citibank, years ago was disclosed as being a drug laundering bank, right? So that's really what some of these things are about, is about making it easier for the banks to have access to, free trade, in the sense of being able to access current foreign countries' money. And oftentimes the money is dirty money, but ultimately, it props up the power of the banking industry.
Does any of this go back to the opium dealing and trading into China that the British initiated years ago, centuries ago?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. That's a very critical point.
Yeah, you're saying that this drug stuff is controlled by the upper level, the elites, the internationalists. Is that sort of what you're saying here?
Well, yeah, I mean, the book doesn't get into the opium war. I mean, if you want to get into the real, if you really want to get into the drug thing, you've got to read Dope Inc. Dope Inc. is the classic book on this and exposes those relationships precisely between the elites, what were called the Boston Brahmins of, the East Coast establishment, the blue bloods, types like the Forbes and, John Kerry's ancestors and, people like, Forbes, Perkins, a lot of those famous East Coast families were involved in not just opium but also slave trafficking. And again, they had very strong relationships with the British merchant banks and the sort of the British elite, let's say. That those relationships are very much the predicate of what becomes the New World Order, because really, the United States has no reason for joining the British in the First World War, right? This is always, a real stick for us. We don't really reflect on the First World War. We always say the Second World War. Well, naturally, the Second World War, of course, how can you argue against trying to stop Nazi Germany and fascist Japan and fascist Italy from trying to conquer the world? But the problem is the First World War is not that simple. There's no natural, aside from the language, there's no natural affinity for the United States and Great Britain at that time. We fought them twice now at that point, and the third time actually was the Civil War, where the British had backed the South because they saw the South as their access to basically cheap cotton, right, for their textile mills.
Right.
So the British were actually very much promoting the Southern secession. And actually, the Russians were had to send their ships to San Francisco and New York to basically say, look, if any of the continental powers try to intervene in the Civil War in the United States, we will intervene on behalf of the U.S. Union, right, the federal government.
Right.
So from that point forward, from this time in the 60s, the British are very clearly, anti-democracy. They're very much pro-slavery still. They don't want to promote it. Maybe they don't want to use it domestically, but they're happy to use slave-like labor to get as cheap goods as possible for their free trade mechanisms. And, even south of the United States and Mexico, the British and the French are working to overthrow the Mexican Republic, right, and install this king, this dictator on the throne down there. So the British are basically notoriously fascist empire.
Right.
There's no reason for the United States to join them in the First World War except for these Boston Brahmin and these blue blood families. Who are allied intellectually and financially.
Right, exactly. And you make a point also. William Yandell Elliott was a Rhodes Scholar, was he not?
Well, that's the point. The Rhodes Scholarship was a means by which the British Roundtable Group were trying to perpetuate their ideology. They were basically saying, look, we need to adopt a few people from all of our empire, as well as the United States, every year to come here and study our ways. And that's what the Rhodes Scholarship was about. It's what Cecil Rhodes, who was notorious, he's an imperialist. He's someone who helps establish the concentration camp system in South Africa. Not concentration camp. It was called, they were called concentration camps ultimately during the Boer War. Basically a very militaristic guy whose drive is for wealth and for diamonds, accessing diamonds in South Africa. And his banker is the Rothschild family, Lord Rothschild at the time. So he is basically this instrument of British Empire pushing for access to Africa's minerals, right, raw materials and goods. And he ultimately envisions, it's a very bizarre story because he says, basically like the Jesuits and the Masons have their conspiracy, we should have our conspiracy as the British Empire to reincorporate America, to basically get the Holy Land and all these different parts of the world under British rule, right? And it's our laws, it's our principles and our values that are so important and so appealing that we can sway these lands to our side, to our cause. And it was very much a white man's burden mentality. It was not about, respecting any of the indigenous peoples or any of their customs. But that's always been the mentality of these imperialists, is saying, well, it just happens that you're born, if you're Arab, for example, you happen to be born upon oil. It's not because you're some great culture. You just the circumstance, of history. It's a sort of, how do you say, it's a accident of history. So the imperial mentality as well, those resources should belong to us, and we are we are more enlightened. We have the understanding of what to do with these things. We know how to allocate them. So we need to access the resources under the guise of what is called the commonwealth or the common good, right? And that's very much the way that the empire operates, is through this kind of Kant. It's just, it's saying what people want to hear, meanwhile operating always towards its own sort of the benefit of the elites.
Right. Elliot was Kissinger was a protege of Elliot. Is that right?
So Kissinger very much was a protege, and it's interesting because until I did my thesis, most people never really mentioned Elliot in their books on Kissinger. It was sort of in passing. Then Niall Ferguson ended up doing a more massive tome on Kissinger, basically his early years, right? And in the process, I sent his people my thesis, and you can see it's cited in Niall's book a few times because he was focusing on Elliot. And yes, Elliot was very influential. Now it's a question of how much did Kissinger break intellectually from him. Obviously, we all know we have mentors in our life, and then sometimes we go on our own path at a certain point, and we have arguments, and we take, we obviously have to have our own mind at certain points. So you're not going to say Kissinger is not a clone of Eliot by any means, but if you look at the book, the argument is it's this balance of power concept is very much a British imperial politics concept, right? The idea was that was British politics for you. The notion that, well, we'll give, the Russians certain territory, but if they cross that if they cross the bounds into like Afghanistan, let's say, or try to enter the heartland region of Asia, which is really the heartland is considered like the Middle East, basically up to like in, the border of India, Afghanistan, in the West, it'll be like Turkey and, some of the Balkan region. Like all of this is sort of the heartland. If the Russians try to get too much of control of this part of the world, that's when we draw the line. That's sort of balance of power, right? So it's like, you know, you have a certain region of power, of empire, we have our empire, and we have like a certain understanding of force that's balancing out. That's very much imperial politics, because the United States national notion is, well, look, you have nation states, right? And nations have should have a constitution and should have a certain, a certain sovereignty within their region and then within their territory, their sovereign territory. And then if they try to basically violate another nation's sovereign territory, that's the point when you might make an alliance to check that advance, that to try to stop aggression, right?
Right.
Unjust. Right. That would be, you know, defensive means would be the only reason for warfare. But the imperial politics is not really interested in that. It's more interested in, again, it's power politics. It's about accessing and controlling resources and, you know, cutting deals, and it doesn't have any conception of what's called national sovereignty.
Right. Now, Ferguson, did he not write a history of the Rothschild family, I believe? Yeah.
Yes, he did.
And yes, so he's pretty closely aligned with them, of course. And I think he's out of Harvard today, I believe. And Kissinger always shows up at the Bilderberg Group. Is that the top of the feeding chain here, the Bilderberg Group?
So we talk about the Bilderberg Group in the book to a certain extent.
Right, right.
You know, and obviously it's difficult to know what's the top of the food chain. Obviously, we know that there is a tremendous there are tremendous personalities that go to the Bilderberg meetings every year, right?
Sure.
Each year,
yeah.
They're inviting, you know, very influential people from, whether it be, you know, Google now or, you know, historically, you know, the heads of the certain press outlets, political figures, you know, like Clinton being invited right before he gets the presidency the following year, I believe. Things like this might take place. I'm sure they have discussions like this about what the agenda might be for 1 year, 5 years, 10 years. You know, mostly it's just a think. I think of it as a think tank for the most part.
Right.
They pass around papers. They have discussions. They basically are setting the agenda for what they would like to see come. I don't think it always occurs that way. That they may have, you know, they may want something to occur. I don't think they can necessarily force it every time. It's not like they're all powerful, but they certainly have an agenda and have steering committee of people like Kissinger, who obviously are tremendous eminence grease behind the scenes in terms of their influence over politicians and as considered very strong advisors. David Rockefeller is like a long time head of Bilderberg, as well as Trilateral Commission. So again, to me, it's more a question of these groups, like the Council on Foreign Relations, the United States as well. Actually, I would say Bilderberg is sort of Council on Foreign Relations writ large. It's a place where the elite can come together, and the self-appointed elite, let's say, and basically have their conversations and assess the political strategy, you know, for the countries and what they think might have to play out in the coming years. But again, it's difficult to know at what level they have, you know, are they able to make sure things happen. We obviously say that they have more influence than most people, but I don't know that they are necessarily, you know, the grand masters at the end of the day. There's not it seems to me there might be an esoteric or Masonic element to certain things that are going on, because there are indications to me of ritual and magic at a certain level. And this gets into the darker side of history. It's harder to, even harder to explore than Bilderberg and Trilateral Commission and CFR.
Yeah, you almost have to be an insider to be there at those ceremonies to see who's there and everything to really understand this. The World Economic Forum, like Charlotte, we've covered that a number of years, have we not?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Charlotte and I have both been able to, when you have 25 international corporations meet in one place for a few days, that's a lot of power, is it not, Sean?
Well, we presume it is. It's a lot of money.
Right. So, I mean, they have a lot of influence, too. And Kissinger, the same old wax museum guy show up, like Kissinger and all those people, you know, at the World Economic Forum. And they're always pushing this public-private partnership. Look like they're buying up the world, You know?
Yeah.
What would be your comment? They're buying up the infrastructure, it looks like. What do you think?
Right, right. Well, that seems to be one of the strategies that these people utilize, is the notion of, how do you say, public-private partnership, which is, how do you say, it's been misconstrued, because on one level, you look at the American system of economics, right, and there's this tremendous history that's been kind of wiped out from the history books. You know, I studied at Princeton. I never heard about the American system until I left, because they cut out the characters like Henry Clay, Henry Carey, what was considered like the Hamilton, Ben Franklin tradition of economics, which was more, you know, the government is going to basically launch initiatives in infrastructure and manufacturers to make sure we protect our domestic manufacturers with tariffs. We invest in infrastructure projects, things that help markets to grow, right? Markets need, you can't just have a market in the middle of a desert if there's no road to get to the market, right? So
right,
who's
right.
going to help? Who's going to build the roads? Well, the government is more incentivized because it's supposed to represent the people. So the government's more incentivized to build the road or the rail system, you know, or the canals, you know, the dams for energy projects, all these things that allow for, you know, sort of cheaper access and flow of goods, so then people can come together in a market. And at that point, yes, of course, they can have free trade, but you have to protect your trade as well. You can't have, you know, cheap products coming in from South America or from China, and they're dumping projects at a cutthroat rate that then drives your wages down. So this is what the American system was fighting against. They're basically saying, look, there's a harmony of interest, because you're ultimately, it's what Henry Ford said, it's your worker is also your consumer. So if you're paying your workers a good wage, guess what? They're going to be able to buy and afford your goods. What this country did by the banks taking over our system, really by the, I would say the corporations too are very much under the control of banks, right? And that they have to make a certain profit just to survive. They have to answer to their stockholders. They have to basically answer to the preferred stockholders and the people in charge, you know, who select the CEOs and whatnot. So that's really what's driving the corporations, is the financial sector. And the financial sector is saying, look, we don't care what you're making. You can make $1 a day as long as we can have you on a debt basis, where we can basically can say, okay, we're going to give you a credit card. And if you fail to make payment, we can start collecting on other things. We can start collecting on, you know, your house, your car, you know, you name it.
Right.
We're going to lay claim to it, because you are too in debt to actually own anything in your life. So they don't care what you're making. You see, the bank says, that's great. You know, you don't make, you know, you're making, you know, low wages. That's not a problem. You know, we'll let you access debt. And then from there, you're just going to sink yourself into deeper debt. I mean, look at what the kids are going to school now. You know, that's the biggest debt in history, right? These trillions
right.
of dollars.
Boy, that is tremendous, isn't it? What are we going to do about that college debt? Is it just, I mean,
it's just ridiculous. I mean, think about it. Like, you know, you know, people went to college in the 60s and 70s. You know, they went to state colleges. They paid, what, $100 for a semester?
Yeah,
you know?
You say that. In 62, I was at the University of Texas. The tuition was $50 a semester.
Right.
And for another $50, it would pay for all of your books and a blanket tax to go to all the UT games. For $100 a semester. Yeah, Charlotte. Anyway, that's what it cost us in 1962. And look at what's happened now. They just can't afford, what, $3,000, $5,000, $10,000 a semester or more? And even in community colleges.
Mm-hmm.
So, gosh, I just don't know where we're headed on the education end of the things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, that's the point, is that everything has been financialized. So that the banks can get into it, right? They get into play, the banks, the insurance companies, all these guys can get into play to basically speculate and turn things into debt, where, you know, there used to be actual real, you know, wages, right? People had actual wages. They were able to actually, you know, own something, you know, straight up.
Debt.
They didn't have to go into years and endless debt, basically. And that's, I think, what's sinking the country. So, well, I would say the public-private partnership has been about, to me, is this notion that, you know, originally we have an American system that wants to promote infrastructure and industry, and then markets can thrive from there. Now you're basically going to the place of, well, let's take everything that's been public, whether it's the military, right, or I think in the future we're going to see, like, the police force, the fire department, all these things will become more and more privatized, right? Just like when we see the military, right? So it's like what used to be the military
the
was.
The prisons have become that way already. Some of the prison systems.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. And so they're going to move into the local law enforcement. And does Trump present a real problem, a barrier to them in their future, this new world order that you describe in your book? Is that why they're so much against him?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. On one level, I would say, sure, it seems that the elite, as far as the Rockefeller-level elite, do seem to be opposed to Trump because they are scared of his rhetoric about not being as not promoting their foreign wars, for example, not wanting to commit America to endless foreign engagements and, these silly conflicts that were constantly being, hoodwinked into supporting, Syria, right? Syria now, Iraq before, Libya before, you name it. I mean, it's just historically, it goes back. We just constantly are engaging in these ridiculous wars that have nothing to do with America and are not helping our country in any capacity. So on one level, Trump seems to be supporting that mentality and saying we need to protect our borders and all this. Right. On the other hand, Trump has this relationship. He's part of the billionaires club. Right. I don't see him in any way caring about the little people. I don't see that actually being any kind of genuine notion on his part. So it's difficult to know that if it's not ultimately just literally another mirage, just like Obama was a mirage of saying, here's a black progressive male who's ultimately completely not that. He's the opposite. He's basically Bush too. right. I think Trump is another mirage that's put out, who's supposed to be the anti-establishment guy, and they've done this before. Don't forget, they've pushed it. So if he's really Barry Goldwater, I'd be surprised if he ended up being that genuinely.
Gentlemen, last night I watched him in Florida, and he actually claimed that he would not honor NAFTA. He said it had to be rescinded. Or used legal speak. I forget exactly how he put it. But, I don't know. I just wanted you to know that. He did say that NAFTA had to go.
Yeah.
Isn't that an important point, Sean, about this trade?
Mm-hmm.
They have to get someone in there that supports these trade agreements. Is that right? They want to support their international trade agreements, right?
You could also put it this way, though.
Okay.
What it looks like is coming up.
Right.
Is a tremendous another crash, right? I mean, we never really recovered from 2008.
Right. We've got a problem coming, a financial crisis.
We have things coming.
You bet. It's coming.
So the idea would be then, well, what if you use the Trump, presidency, if he wins? And I would be surprised if he wins, but let's say that, because for me, at the end of the day, most of the elections are really, I think elections usually have taken, there's already a selection process that takes place just to get you to that level. But then I think it's more about gauging the public consciousness more than anything.
Exactly,
you see that this is their way of kind of seeing, okay, where are people at in their mindset? What do people, want right now? And then, most of the time, oftentimes, they come into office and they do the exact opposite of what they said.
Exactly.
So it's really not about, so it's not about truth.
No.
But if Trump did win, obviously a lot of people are saying, look, the economy's going to crash because he's not going to honor our trade commitments. He's not going to honor our, certain debt that's owed. And, it's just, basically it's going to sink the U.S. economy. Now, this collapse is going to have to come one way or another in a certain form just because of what we're looking at as far as the amount of debt that's owed, the amount of derivatives that are still out there some people are saying quadrillions of dollars. At this point, some people are even saying quadrillion dollars of derivatives because it's such high numbers.
Right.
So the whole thing is, can the system, does it have to be reset anyway? Does it have to be shifted over more to, we talked at the beginning about Amero. Well, the Amero may not come into play, but it might be digital currencies are going to become the new future, right?
Well, that's what's going to happen, digital money. I mean, electronic banking. That's going to take over.
And we're getting closer to that. So at a point that, the singularity has to occur and you have to shift over completely to your digital economy, you have to crack. And that's when you might need the wrecking ball. The wrecking ball might be Trump. Maybe not this year, but again, it's just kind of, that's sometimes what kind of, how do you say, the game becomes, is using someone like Trump, if he does win, as the excuse for the crash, you see? Because right. There always has to be some reason. There has to be, they have to explain it somehow to justify what's taking place to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What did you say, Charlotte?
I couldn't agree more. I think Trump is the WikiLeaks. I don't know how much you depend on those as legitimate, but some of the WikiLeaks showed that Trump, Cruz, and one other person were at the top of the people that Hillary wanted to run against. And they actually, you know, gamed it and talked about it. And, you know, I think he could very well be the setup, the fall guy for when everything goes south.
But I think he's a surprise. I think he's actually believing that he can change things and reform things, you know. Somewhere in his running this last year, he started like last summer, he got the idea that he can affect a change here. That's what I sort of get an impression of his. I've watched most of his speeches, you know, and it seems to around the working guy, the working class people, the average person, he seems to be a defender of them, and he says he will fight for them. He repeats that over and over again, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to believe him.
But he still has the billions, right?
Yeah. or at least he's a fake billionaire, but either way, he plays a billionaire on TV, so, I mean, I think he's a narcissist at the end of the day. So I don't know that I don't believe his sincerity. On the other hand, I would love to, because I like what he says more than I like what Clinton says. But it's like, you know, at the end of the day, who can you trust? It's like, you know, they're both narcissistic personalities, so you can't trust either one.
Right. You made an important point about drug dealing and all this about Oliver North, but that Mena, Arkansas, was one of the import destinations from my readings and studies, and I've studied this Clinton couple since the 90s, since 1990 onward. And that Mena, and they, I mean, so they're all tied up into, and one of the important points about Hillary, the supporters of Hillary, is that BlackRock, the largest investment asset company in the world, $4.5 trillion under their management, is behind Hillary. So that says the big money is behind Hillary. And in these recent emails, it brings out she'll talk to, you know, the Goldman Sachs people one way, and then she's talking in the her campaign exactly the opposite way. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So
I mean, I don't follow. I mean, again, like you mentioned WikiLeaks. You know, I'm not following everything that's coming out as far as all these, you know, email transactions. But again, I just, you look at the history and you understand it's, you know, here's someone who, as Secretary of State, promoted this ridiculous war against Gaddafi, right? She's promoted this war against Assad. Even now, he essentially wants to back the Al-Qaeda, you know, insurgents against Assad. It's just, it's pure New World Order propaganda at this point, because there's no reason for us to be going around destroying these countries unless you're looking at the New World Order thing, which is, well, they're going to redraw the map of the Middle East, right? They're trying to smash nation states, which is, again, very much the essence of what New World Order is about. It's saying
they can't destroy nation states.
And the United States has been destroyed in a different way. So the war on the United States has been more of an economic war that's been gradual by forcing us to turn into this military arsenal for, you know, British imperial politics, and taking us away from our blue collar, science and technology driven industries.
Exactly.
You know, that's really what made America great.
Right. They've carved that. You couldn't have said it better. I see it on two levels. There's a cultural war against America, and then there's this economic thing that's a financial domination of the country through the Fed and subsequent financial institutions over the last decades, you know.
Precisely. And that's just an ongoing war.
It's ongoing, exactly.
Worse and worse, like usury,
that's it. Isn't it interest that's the fuel of the monster or the...
you could say, I mean, certainly, I would say usury is a certain aspect of it. We talked about debt before, because, you know, at the end of the day, it's like there's nothing, you know, the notion of credit is incredible.
Right.
But the problem is we've gone from the notion of credit where it's like we're trying to, you know, you're trying to empower the future. You're trying to empower people to do things, to be entrepreneurial, to, you know, to create. You go from that into a debt system where it's basically, you know, it's kind of like what we saw with the housing scams, where it was like, here, we'll give you, you know, 0%. But then, you know, within a year, it goes up to 20%, right, or something ridiculous that people can't be expected to pay back.
Right.
And that's what happens too much. Is to me, it's heavy usury, and it's also speculation. You see, it's very much a casino culture
taking over.
And I think that's the main cultural war that you talk about, is a mixture of cultural and financial war, is speculation and gambling, because they want people to believe, well, I'm not making a living wage, so I should just go to the casino and gamble what I have to see if I can make a fortune. And they sell that to you on TV. So it's the same thing with, you know, the rappers and the Kardashians and the famous, you know, the celebrities that are being pushed to you. It's like, well, you see, he made it from the bottom to the top, right? Like, he made it, he got lucky, so you can go and you can gamble too, and you can get lucky. And that's what they want to sell you, is this whole notion of, well, it's not like hard work and being able to make a decent wage and, you know, buy a house and pay it off within a certain time because you're making good money. It's like, no, you can go out there and hit the jackpot and become a billionaire.
Well, that's a good point. Have we raised a bunch of cheating and hustlers and gamblers in this country now? Is that really what's very widespread out there? Hit the lottery, cheat somebody. It's sort of like hustle somebody out of something instead of working hard, you know, to get something.
Yeah, and that's what Trump, I mean, let's be honest, that's what Trump kind of epitomizes too, which is why I say, like, let's not be too fooled by his, you know, his demeanor, because if he ends up being genuine, I would love it. It's just, what does his history show is someone who basically, like, you know, sells the idea, I have gold here and it's all gold plated lead
that he's trying to sell you, right?
And he's trying to sell everything on his name that, you know, cause it's like he came from a rich family. And you know, he's obviously got, you know, whatever, he does have all these properties, but are they actually, they're hocked up, or does he actually own them really, or is it just all debt and other investors? I'm sure that's it. He's part of the billionaires club, right? So people want to invest in the name, even if there's no actual, like, you know, how do you say, owned assets behind them.
Right. It's an interesting election year. Charlotte and we had our first interview nearly 10 years ago. It'd be November 1 this coming November. That was on election fraud. Can you believe that? And Charlotte, go ahead.
No, it was high tech election theft.
So here we are in the throes of a very interesting, you know what I mean, tumultuous, chaotic, vicious election campaign, and that's what may decide the race. What do you think?
What was the last thing you're saying, that which will decide it?
Election fraud looks like to me they're running
fraud.
a lot of illegal voters or dead people. They're tombstoning the deal, looks like.
Here's the interesting thing. I got to see Greg Palast's new documentary. The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Right.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And you know, it's a really important movie because, yes, there's, you know, we've seen election fraud throughout history. I don't know that anything is going to change that. But what's amazing is what he's saying is how thoroughly, especially when he focuses on the Republican Party, is going after black voters and Latino voters, right, and basically trying to get them off the lists by accusing them of double voting, when oftentimes they only share the same name as someone, you know, they share the same name as another voter, so they're being accused. As long as they're accused of double voting, they're not able to vote. And so he goes after, like, how the Republicans are trying to do it, not to win the election for Trump, but mostly to win the Senate.
Right.
Because obviously they want to control Congress. And he says, you know, Democrats are dirty too, but his focus is on Republican targeting, especially of, you know, black and Latino voters in particular. And so it's a really important documentary. And, yeah, I think vote fraud is, you know, is going to continue. It's a tough thing because on one level, I would love to see more virtual voting, which I think, you know, if you had if you could vote online, you can get your receipt and drop it. You could send your receipt in to the mail or something. That would make sense to me. And then at least, you know, it would engage more young people, because young people aren't going to go to a ballot, you know, to drive to a ballot box and stand in line, you know, to punch punch holes, right? To punch chads, they're not going to do that.
Right.
They're going to, you know, you're going to do it on their phone. And I think this would actually empower more people to engage in voting. And of course, I mean, look, they can always be rigged. It can always be, you know, hacked and tampered with. It's just a question of, you know, what do we, how do we break this system? And I don't really know, like, how to protect completely against it. I do think we can empower more people.
Charlotte, what's the solution to this? Is it paper ballots or what, Charlotte? What do you think, Charlotte?
Well, we need verifiable elections. They've gotten to the point where they don't even verify the electronic voting machines or the tallying.
Right.
You know, they're unverifiable. And however somebody wants to put their mind to it to figure out how we can verify the election, you know, that's what we need, is that ability to go back and do a recount or to be able to verify the election. And it's not that I'm anti-technology or anything, but a lot of people think that has to be handled through exclusively paper ballots, you know, so that's, there you go.
Yeah, paper ballots could do it. I mean, going back to that, this electronic thing is the wrong way. We got to get off of that. I'm convinced that we need to drop that, but it's not going to drop. It's not going to change, I don't think. I don't think we can do it.
Right.
It's embedded in the whole system now, see?
You know? Yeah. You're just never going to engage young people unless it is electronic. I mean, electronics is the name of this game. It's
millennials, what are they into? Gadgets, right?
Huh?
Millennials are into gadgets, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. Digital, I mean, as much as you can do on an app.
Yeah, you know, gotta go with it. Go get an app, man, you know. Play the game, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, get lost in all that gaming and stuff. They're so, I don't know. I can't even, you know, Kardashians, I've never seen an episode of them. I don't even know what they look like on television, hardly. So I missed out. I guess I missed a lot, huh? Huh, Sean? I'm that old guy over the hill, right?
You know, I don't know if it was true or not, but I thought.
Go ahead.
Yeah, me either. But I heard that they're getting in trouble for the robbery in Paris. I don't know if it's true or not, but you know, no, I've never watched them either.
Well, there's something about the value of their jewelry that they were claiming that was in excess of what actually the value is. I don't know. I don't know that much details about it. I read the news on it, so, you know.
Right. Well, it's, you know, again, it's there's a mass brainwashing technique that's deployed against all of us, but especially against young people. You know,
Media.
Media is a tremendous tool for brainwashing. It shapes worldviews, and that people can't imagine that their news is literally dictated to the reporters, you know, or to the journalists, that they're being told these are the stories, you know, this is what you have to focus on, this is what you have to cover, this is what you have to cut out. You know, they can't imagine that. They just want to watch their little idiot box, you know, their MTV, and that's it. That's all they want to, you know, do is just check in and check out,
right?
As opposed to thinking about, you know, what is really going on in this world. It's a much. There are conspiracies. There are people in positions of power that, you know, have the ability to manipulate things. And it's like, if you're around it, you understand it. You're around these, you know, you're around these situations, and you understand. Look, people are conspiring because they can, and most people are not in a position to do it, so they can't fathom, you know, what those who are in positions of power can do.
But what they come up with is conspiracy nuts that dwell on this too much, right?
Sure. I've heard that all my life.
Yeah, I'm a conspiracy nut. I admit it.
Right. Well, that's the thing that they've always, you know, it's not even just about dismissing you as a conspiracy nut. It's the fact that they don't even want to think about it. They say, well, I don't have time to think about this or worry about this. What's it for me? It's not my problem. And it's like, well, sure. It's like saying the cliff is not your problem until you fall off the edge.
Exactly.
So you want to walk around in your ignorance.
You
want to walk around in your ignorance, and you don't want to be aware of your world and your surroundings and what's taking place.
Right.
Sure. Then, you know, go ahead and walk off the cliff. Be like the sheep, get fleece, and then take it to the slaughterhouse.
Right.
Because that's really what you are to the people in power. Is, you know, you're just a sheep. You're just, you know, great. We can hypnotize you first. You know, we tell you to, you know, we're here for your best interest. And, you know, you're just being culled. You're just being, you know, populations are really, the real war is never against foreign countries. The war is against between the rulers of a country and its own people. That's really the war
that we have to deal with. It's like thought prison, I think, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's a mind control, but it's really sophisticated with all this media hype out there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the consolidation of the media into five or six different companies, conglomerates, has made it worse, huh?
Well, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. It makes it worse.
You've got some speaking engagements coming up in the near future. I think the Oswald Conference and then the JFK thing in Dallas. Are both of those on your schedule?
Yes, I'll be talking this coming Friday night in New Orleans, and we'll be talking at the Oswald Conference, as you mentioned, and I'll be just discussing the book and doing really mostly it'll be a Q&A, honestly. I like engaging with people and just having a discussion like this as opposed to lecturing. I'm not much of a professor type. I'm more of a...
No, you're sounding good. This is very interesting so far. It's been very excellent interview. And you're well spoken. You've got that historical base, which is very important, isn't it? Huh?
I think history is the most important thing to study. I would say we used to have this notion of liberal arts education rooted in your social science, social studies, right? History and literature, in math and science, basic things. And now it's amazing to me how people are just getting to the place where they don't have to even study their basic education becomes, well, don't worry about any of the old, liberal arts, just focus on, gender studies or communication or some specialty, some niche, which, I'm all for studying more, but you still have to have a basic understanding. You still have to have your roots, your base built in order to then specialize and focus.
Right. In your book, you're describing some of the key individuals that together have affected foreign policy, and actually Brzezinski and those people, they're still here affecting it. Huntington, I believe, has passed away, Samuel Huntington. But in your book, then, you're really saying that the British influence has been very great through their schoolings and the Rhodes Scholarships and the roundtables and all that. And then Kissinger and all of them are actually carrying out their orders almost in a way, are they not?
Well, who would you say are carrying out the orders?
Kissinger and Brzezinski and them have been sort of programmed by this British imperialism thing. Are they not sort of programmed like little puppets carrying out the British commandments or what?
See, that's an interesting question because Kissinger did say in his address at Chatham House, which is the Royal Institute of International Affairs, basically the British Council on Foreign Relations, he said that he really... he owed a great debt to the Foreign Office of the British Empire. How he was basically working oftentimes off of their white papers. So they would issue papers, and then as Secretary of State, he would basically work off of the British papers.
It
was pretty interesting, revelation. As far as being a puppy, I think Kissinger is a mixture of things. He's also very much Rockefeller, right? I mean, he's basically an apparatchik of the Rockefeller family. Kissinger is tied up with these, really these mass financial and corporate interests that have no loyalty to the United States as a country. Their loyalty is to, accessing trade and money and, making profit. That's why his Kissinger Associates represents, some of the worst people in the world, right? Because it's about finance, and finance oftentimes comes with blood. So I would say, is it just British? I don't know if it's only British. I think it's more of this, again, it's been adopted into the New World Order. It's like, we're just going to go beyond nation states. We're going to go into this place of corporate control, of, again, legal obligations, supranational authorities, and agreements. And this will ultimately, I think, lead more towards corporations taking over the roles and functions of government, as we've seen with privatization of, as you mentioned, prisons, military, you name it, energy and other technologies. It's like it's all going to be privatized more and more. And as it goes into the private sector, even intelligence gathering, as it goes into the private sector, we have less oversight as, so-called citizens of these countries. not to say our governments really give us that much oversight, but really it's just shifting more and more away from any kind of notion of a government that represents the people.
Right. Then that corporation umbrella that's going to take out the constitutional governments is becoming a corporate fascist type of mechanism, would you say, or not?
Well, I mean, the fascism, as Mussolini put it, was the marriage of corporations with government, right?
Right, right.
That was very much the way that he envisioned it.
Right.
Now, whether or not there's a racial component can be argued, yes, sometimes there's racism, but it doesn't have to be. H.G. Wells, who was part of this whole group of, you know, British imperialists at the Roundtable group, he said, you know, the New World Order and the open conspiracy was about incorporating the other races into our conspiracy, at least the elites from those races, you know, the Obama types, right, who get incorporated into it and they become apparatchiks of it. So I think fascism is the marriage of public and private, the marriage of corporations and government. You're seeing it very well with surveillance, all the surveillance stuff. The National Security Agency is really just accessing the corporation's ability to access our data, right? It's like the corporations who are doing the bidding of state, right? Whether it's Google or Yahoo or Facebook or whatever. It's like, okay, you guys as private corporations contract with the people, and then you contract with us, the government, separately and give us access to the people. That's fascism to me.
Well, now that is a really good example right there. Well, you have Google or someone that's got right connected right into NSA, you know? And so what are your solutions on some of the, what would you put forward is what we need to do? And not only are you alerting and exposing this system, and from a very good new angle here with this Elliott fella, but what would you suggest that we do from here on? We've got about 5 minutes left in our program. What would you do, and what would you suggest that we do to reform it or to move this thing towards a more positive conclusion?
Future?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a tough thing. I mean, certainly as I'm doing a documentary as well for RT, that's kind of, we talked about this throughout the show today, but focus, this documentary is called Century of War, and it'll be coming out next month on RT, online, RT.com. And basically, you know, Century of War is very much on these topics we've discussed, which are, meaning the deindustrialization of America, the destruction of our blue-collar jobs, the crumbling infrastructure, the fact that our government is not doing the investments in the things that allow for our markets to thrive. And it's like, how do we turn that around? How do we have a future for our people and not just, you know, slogans like Make America Great Again? Well, there's certain things you have to do. I mean, do you have to completely negate every international treaty? No, it's not that. You'd have to look at them and reassess what, you know, what is viable and valuable to the United States. But I'm all for what Kennedy talked about, which was fair trade. You know, it's like you don't have free trade. There's no free trade that ever exists in the planet.
Right.
You know, free trade only leads to monopolies, right? It's like the bigger fish just ends up eating everyone else in the sea and saying, well, that's fair trade for you, and now I'm the biggest fish, and no one's going to stop me.
Excellent point, man.
You have to have fair trade. Fair trade is saying, look, United States doesn't grow, you know, we don't grow rice, for example, so we'll trade you, you know, what we grow, which might, you know, corn and bread, we'll trade for rice. You know, that would make sense. That's the things that you don't, that you cannot create, which are more like, how do you say, agriculture and things that you cannot grow. That's the kind of thing you trade for. And then, you know, when it comes to things you can build, you know, whether it be automobiles and whatnot, you have to have certain protections on, you know, as far as tariffs go. That's what they have in Europe, right? They have value-added taxes and whatnot. So you have to protect your manufacturers and your science and technology sector that, you know, needs a certain level of protection. But then, you know, to me, actually, one of the biggest things I would say that's complicated, the situation is patent law.
Okay.
Right? And how this is just going off topic a little bit, but I think patent law is fascinating because on one level, it's like you say, yeah, we want to see, you know, science and technology and things, innovations be respected as far as, you know, the creators having to make profit. But at the same time, if your profit is demanding such a high rate that you're basically ending up to, you know, charging people hundreds of dollars for, you know, a single pill, right? It basically, you know, it leaves the market in the place where most people cannot access it, can't afford to. And that's why people in foreign, you know, third world countries or in India are basically saying, okay, well, we're just going to reverse engineer it. The Chinese are good at this. We'll just reverse engineer and do it cheaper, right? So there has to be a certain, how do you say, we have to find the right value for things again. I think we're at a place where we overvalue money, and it has to do with the debt system and the fact that everyone is in debt. So we have to, in a sense, where everyone is overvaluing money, and we're undervaluing creativity and the wealth that every human being has innately, which is their creative mind. If we respected and recognized this value, the beauty of that every human being has something to offer, there's a harmony of interests, right? That everyone does something and does a unique trade, a unique craft in their own unique way. And then we could come to respect and value that. That's the ultimate revolution that I think is going to change the world. Everything short of that is only going to keep the game going, right, in a different way, where it's like, you know, so someone else will come out on top. Well, we can have a revolution tomorrow, and you'll end up with the Castro who, you know, comes into power promising reform and ends up staying in there for 50 years and keeps the country stagnant, right? It's very difficult to talk about what's going to transform the planet except to say that I believe very much in human creativity. I think that science, technology, innovation, these are the things that are going to transform things. But we have to give people the means of doing, of going out there and creating. We have to give them the credit necessary to go out there and create and do things. And we have to see the circular nature of life, which is if I give to you, you're going to be able to give to someone else. And, you know, we can pay it forward in a sense. That's what has to be done. We have to get out of this fear of scarcity, the fear of lack, you know, the fear of fear itself, in a sense, is what most people are living under.
Well, that's a beautiful ending of our program. I want to thank you. And Charlotte, how about closing comments from you?
Oh, I just wanted to thank Sean for being with us today. And are you, can I catch you on RT? Are you still doing, watching the Hawks?
Yes, I do Watching the Hawks, which is it's a daily news program. So I co-host that show. I do Buzzsaw is coming back on Gaia TV, so people can keep an eye out for my Buzzsaw online interviews. And as I said, this documentary, Century of War, which will be on Watching the Hawks next month.
Okay.
And then the book, which is out now.
Okay. Well, we want to thank you very much for being with us this evening. And Charlotte, anything else?
No, thank you very much, Sean. Keep up the good work.
Sean Stone, thank you very much. And you're really a positive force for our society. And we honor and respect your work. Okay?
I appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.